You are listening to inspiring stories of ordinary people doing extraordinary stuff. Welcome to the Doolanders.
Hit it!
That's what I'm talking about.
Wait!
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Hit it, boys.
Well, welcome, Doolanders. This is episode number 49. Who would have thought?
Unbelievable. Here we are, nearly at the half century. Nick, who have we got on this week?
Today we have the CEO of Crime Stoppers Victoria, Stella Smith. Tell us a little bit about Stella before we get into the main interview, Blake.
Stella, an amazing woman. And as you said, CEO of Crime Stoppers. She has been a person that's been focused on creating great community outcomes for many, many years. Nick, let's get straight into it. Here's Stella.
Hey, Blake, before we get stuck into this episode,
yeah,
where should our listeners go if they want to hear more stories of people doing?
They should jump on to www.thedoolanders.com.au. And what will they find there, Nick?
No, not .com.au, Blake, just .com.
Oh.
Don't make that mistake. You can hit us up on Facebook. You can hit us up on Instagram and our website, and you can find a whole heap of pictures, articles, links.
Recipes?
Not a ton of recipes,
okay.
But you just never know what you'll find. TheDoolanders.com. No.au.
Do it.
Okay, now, from the beginning.
Stella Smith, welcome to the Doolanders. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you. How are you?
I am fantastic on this beautiful, beautiful Friday morning. How are you, Nick?
I'm pretty good, but I'm furry. I'm covered in dog fur.
You are covered in dog fur, which I'm surprised that dog fur hasn't frozen and snapped off your T-shirt because it is absolutely freezing this morning, isn't it?
It is. It's very cold, but it's a beautiful view out there. It's nice and sunny and very green.
Yeah, it is. It is an amazing view. Hey, Stella, we always like to ask our guests, firstly, who are you and what do you do?
I'm Stella Smith and yep. I'm the Chief Executive of Crime Stoppers Victoria.
All right. Now, there's so much to your story and we can't wait to unpack it. So I've seen and experienced Crime Stoppers for years and years and years, and I was having a look yesterday, just the impact that the organisation has made over the journey. It's been quite phenomenal. So I was reading there's been 102,000 charges laid. Is that right?
Correct.
$380 million of contraband has been seized.
Correct.
26,000 arrests.
Yes.
And 1.1 million calls or contacts from the general public.
We've actually passed the 1.2 million yep. calls and contacts.
Okay, well, I should have got my data correct
no,
there.
So no, you wouldn't know because it's only just been.
That's an exclusive.
Yep. So all of that's happened from basically tips and information from the general public.
That's correct.
Yeah, it is amazing. Tell us the Crime Stoppers story. Like, where did it start?
Crime Stoppers started in New Mexico. And was started by a policeman who was looking for information on a homicide that occurred at a petrol station. And he knew that local people had information and they weren't coming forward.
Mm.
So he'd had some media experience and he reached out to the network and they started to promote this case. And within a matter of weeks, they had it solved. They announced a reward for it and people started to call in with information and they solved it.
Yeah, wow. And what about in Australia?
It was brought to Australia by a gentleman by the name of Jeff Wilkinson. He is the founder of Crime Stoppers and it started here in Victoria.
Right.
And he did this as part of he went to various programs around the world having a look at different crime prevention programs as part of his Churchill Fellowship. And he was the head of media at Victoria Police back in those days.
Mm.
And he brought it to Melbourne and then it rolled out around the country. So each of the Crime Stoppers agencies in Australia works with their local police jurisdiction.
Right.
And then we have a whole Crime Stoppers Australia and each of us has a representative on the Crime Stoppers Australia board.
Right, okay.
So we do national initiatives and yep. But we're mainly focused on our state because the laws are different in each state and the police jurisdictions are different.
Yeah, okay. when you think about the trend of, you know, people calling into Crime Stoppers, is it on the way up or on the way down?
It's on the way up. And I think there are a number of reasons for that, but it has increased pretty much year on year.
Wow.
And this last financial year, 92,003 people, let's not forget the three.
The three, yeah, they're important.
92,003 people contacted Crime Stoppers in Victoria. And they can do that through an online system. So we have a reporting application that a new one that was released in February of this year, and we've made it as easy for people to report or to share information with us as they can, and others will call. They call on the phones, they come on the online reports. You can report in different languages, and we've really tried to make it as easy for people, and we're trying to take away that fear of coming forward.
Mm.
And lots of people have information. They're often reluctant to come forward. They don't want to go to police because, you know, they might be scared. They might not want to get involved. They might worry about being in a court case somewhere down the track.
Yeah.
And Crime Stoppers is here to take away that fear.
Right. And when you think about the way that people are contacting you, you know, has that shifted from over the phone to online? Do people now send in, I don't know, videos that perhaps they may have captured something and thought this is a bit dodgy and they send it? Like, how's that all playing out?
So we put a lot of thought into how people engage with Crime Stoppers, and our primary concern is their safety. So everything is about protecting the person who comes to us. So if you look at our online reporting system, you can upload dash cam footage, you can upload photos. You can choose whether you remain anonymous. So if you tick the box to remain anonymous, it strips the metadata out of your videos before they're uploaded.
Oh, right.
So we take this really seriously.
Yeah.
And we're doing everything we can to protect people. We're mindful of the environment that people are in. You know, sometimes people are very close to crime. So we're careful to de-risk it as much as I can. So we at one point we thought about putting the camera in there saying, can you, you could take a snapshot and just upload it. But there's a risk to somebody doing that. So, you know, we don't want people standing out the front of the organised crime house snapping away and injuring themselves. You know, there's a risk there. So everything we do, we're thinking about the risk to the people who come to us.
Yeah.
And it's why you don't hear so much about what we've achieved. You know, Crime Stoppers, information to Crime Stoppers solves at least one homicide in the state every year. We contribute so much information to police intelligence holdings, and it's all coming from the public.
It's amazing, isn't it? You just look at the podcast landscape and, you know, you look at the top 100 podcasts, and I reckon 50, 60, maybe 70% are true crime. There is this fascination in the society, in our community around crime. Do you think that, you know, why is that fascination? Do you have a handle on that one?
No, but I do remember once being asked, I was asked about the sort of job that I'd like to do. It was many years ago. And one of the questions was, would you like to take police material to the lab? And I thought that'd be fantastic. But when you actually think about it, you're just the courier, really. You're just going from one place to another place with stuff.
Yeah.
But to me, I thought that'd be an awesome job. But I think people are fascinated by crime. They don't understand why people behave the way they do, but we don't want that to become the norm. We don't want people desensitized to it. We want a safer community. And if you look at, you know, basic needs, one of the most basic needs that people have is to feel safe.
Yeah.
So do you think people feel safe because they're listening to stories of true crime?
No, I think there's a fascination with it. I don't think they feel safe. I think they can't quite understand how that is. It's outside of their own behaviour most of the time, I think. But there is a fascination. There's no doubt about it. Yeah. And I think we had a podcast go up, I think it was last year actually, on an incident involving an armed robbery, and we had it down within a week because the police now had information to actually make an arrest in that case. So it went up on Monday and came down on Friday. So a whole lot of work went into it. The poor guy who does our podcast was devastated, but we're very happy. We got an outcome.
Yeah.
And that was around an armed robbery where guns had been stolen from a property and then used to commit another crime.
Mm.
And people were so interested in it. They were waiting. It was in three parts and they couldn't get to part three because they hadn't had time. It disappeared before they could get there.
Yeah. We were talking a little earlier around how safe is Australia and how safe is Victoria when you think about it from a, you know, a local and an international perspective. How safe are we?
I think the perceptions of crime are that crime is far worse in Victoria than it is in other parts, you know, or than it actually is. So Victoria is quite a safe place when you compare us to some other parts of the world. But there's always more that we can do to be and to feel safe. And I think the perception of crime is, for most people, how they judge what's going on in the state. But the reality can sometimes be quite different. So things like graffiti-covered neighbourhoods, they affect the way people see their neighbourhood. Lighting is another one, particularly for women. So if the place isn't lit up, then there's a perception that it's not safe and you're not safe.
Mm. You've got a fascinating job as the CEO of Crime Stoppers, and we'll talk about how you got here in a moment. But, you know, what was the appeal to the role for you?
A couple of things, actually. I'm very much about community and the making a contribution to community, whether it's safety, whether it's encouraging people to engage in a different way, whether it's presenting opportunities. That, for me, I really love that piece.
Mm.
And I also saw that the Crime Stoppers brand is phenomenal. So I come from a marketing background and I'm thinking about all of the things that we can do to make Crime Stoppers important to younger people as well, and how we can tap into communities that don't come forward to police. So it for me, it's the difference that we can make in the community.
Yeah. Again, we were talking earlier about, you know, what's your... As the CEO of Crime Stoppers, what's your day look like? And it was, your answer was fascinating. You can tell us, you know, what does a, it's pretty diverse, isn't it? What's a day look like for you?
So I described yesterday. Yeah. So we went back as far as yesterday. We won't go back any further because they are all quite different. But yesterday I started with a meeting about the amnesty with the other jurisdictions around the country. So we're involved in the National Guns Amnesty, and that was the beginning of the day. I then moved on to record a piece for Channel 9. Then it was back to talk about illegal wildlife and conversations about what we're doing in that space.
What's an example of illegal wildlife?
So there are groups that target, they can target international students to export wildlife, and then we have wildlife coming into Australia as well. So it's that trade in illegal wildlife, and the protection of our animals, and you know what people here do to them, and what people overseas are willing to pay for them to get them.
What is the scale of that? Because you see, I like border security, the show. I don't know why, but it's good.
That's good.
Some new news.
Yeah.
You see snakes, you see all that sort of stuff being either incoming or outgoing. What is the level? Because you sort of don't get a good gauge of it watching a TV show.
I think at the moment it's a bit hard to tell really in terms of what's coming in because we don't have the same traffic that we've got in international travel.
Mm.
But we do have, you know, we've had incidents here where animals are posted in the mail to other countries.
What?
So protecting our wildlife is actually really important. It's really important to Australians too. Mm-hmm. So, and then we have other things where we've got, you know, for example, turtles coming in from other parts of the world that are brought in as a lovely pet and then dropped into our river system. So all of those things impact our environment, and Crime Stoppers does some amazing work in that space. You know, we had a post up a while back with a bird with an arrow through its head. And the reaction from the public was one of horror. And they understand that it's not normal for people to do those sorts of things. And they don't like, the public doesn't like it. We don't like it. The public doesn't like it. And we don't like the thought of our wildlife, our animals being hurt or being sold.
Mm. And how does that compare to human reaction, you know, to seeing humans in harm?
Yeah, it is quite interesting. I think people really, it's not that they don't care about people, but I think they see a lot more of that. But they see animals as defenceless and, you know, the reaction on social media is quite strong to posts on injured animals or wildlife that's being hurt in any way. The reaction on quite often when it relates to people is, how could the person do this? So the sympathy is there for, it's still there, but it's there in a different way, I guess. They're looking at, you know, how could a criminal do this? Whereas with the animal, they look at it and think this is a terrible thing to have happened.
Mm. It's what a, you know, that's just yesterday. That's a fascinating...
I haven't finished with yesterday.
Oh, right, okay.
We're only at
point two.
Yeah.
And then it was about the youth advisory group. So we're building a group of young people to give us advice on the best ways for Crime Stoppers to engage the public. And our return to those young people will be to mentor them, to build their networks. So we're really interested in getting information from people, but also helping people develop as well.
Mm. Sounds like there's never a dull moment.
That's true. It's crime. There never is a dull moment.
Yeah.
And just so diverse.
That's true too. So we were discussing scams before, but...
Yeah, well, let's go on to scams. Like, when you think about online safety, or how do you think about online safety today?
I think we need to do more to educate people about the issues being online and to make them more aware of their own behaviour online. It's really difficult to get an outcome once you've handed over your money. And that's not anyone's fault. It's just that it might be in other parts of the world that this scam started. So if you think about a police member getting on a plane, he's not chartering a plane to go over to another country to get your money back for you, because I think that's almost impossible.
Yeah, that's true.
But there is an expectation that can happen, you know. And we have to change our way of thinking. We've been so conditioned to think that if we don't like what we bought, we can go and make a complaint to Consumer Affairs or somebody and there's an outcome. Well, we're now in a global marketplace and we're dealing with global issues, and someone from another country who can, you know, come in on your emails or chat to you online, we just have to be more aware. We have to change our own behaviour.
What do you see with the laws currently? Because the laws are a long way behind technology, and you've got, you know, thousands of years of physical... you know, property, things like that. It's very easy to govern, or at least we've got a history of that. Yet all of a sudden we're thrown into this digital world where it's pretty much just an open pipe. Do you think that governments need to play a bigger role in, I'm not talking about censorship, but I'm talking about maybe guardianship. If you go and buy an internet connection and kids get on the internet connection with, you know, their laptops or iPads or whatever, it's pretty much unfiltered. If the parent doesn't know that you can do something, do you think it should be incumbent on the provider to have an opt-in or opt-out in terms of illicit material, be it pornography, drugs, alcohol, all those sorts of things? Or do you think it should still be, you know, the internet's quite anarchy, it's pretty broken. Just, yep, you've bought the service, now it's up to you, the consumer, to protect whoever's using that connection.
I think we have to start with the consumer understanding more about what's out there, understanding more about the potential risk to them. I'm not sure I'm qualified to talk about the laws in, you know, in relation to cyberspace, and it's evolving all the time. I mean, we're seeing growth in things that we couldn't possibly have imagined years ago. And if I use the Crime Stoppers analogy for that, back in the day when Crime Stoppers first started, we were doing reenactments because there was no CCTV. Now we've got people uploading dash cam. And we're stripping out the metadata to protect their anonymity. So we're talking about things that have evolved in a reasonably fast space of time, a reasonably short space of time. And who knows where that's headed to? You know, we're getting smarter and smarter all the time, but we're not keeping pace ourselves with what we need to do to protect ourselves. Mm. And we just can't say someone needs to fix this for us. We have to say, we're not going to click on that link. Or, you know, I think we've spoken about some of the things, that the scams that go on. And I will use this story. I hesitated before, but I give the example of the, you know, the sweaty man who is in what's known as the boiler room in the Philippines, who, if he knocked on your door and said he was Jane and he loved you dearly, if you gave him your life savings, would you give it to him? And the answer to that is no. So when he comes online and says he's Jane, why do you believe he's Jane?
Yeah. If he was on the front step and he was in a dress, well, maybe you would, but no, you wouldn't.
Still?
No, you wouldn't. But that's right. Like, there's so many scams going on. We talked about the ATO one. You know, I've been called 15 times about, you know, you owe X amount of money, hand it over or you're going to be arrested. So in terms of Crime Stoppers, and it's interesting when you look at your organisation, there's a whole lot of preventative work. It's not just after the event, is it?
That's correct. We're doing more and more in the prevention space. Yeah. And that's not to say, I'm not blaming victims here, so please don't think I am. That's not what this is about. This is about saying, what can we do to help each other? And if you've got elderly relatives, if you've got someone who's living alone, we've really got to get the message across to people that you don't have to hand over your money. I mean, I've been called and told there's a warrant for my arrest, which I think is kind of laughable because I'm sure the police know where to find me if they want me. And I've been told that many times, you know, there's a warrant for your arrest and you need to pay the tax office and come on, like, just no. And I think, you know, take the time, hang it up. You can always call the tax office yourself and check if there's a problem. You could call the police and ask them if there was a warrant, if you were that worried. But, I mean, the reality is these people are not calling you to tell you there's a warrant for your arrest and asking you to hand over cash. I mean, how, I don't know how many laws that breaks. And please don't go and buy vouchers either. Nobody wants you. Nobody that's legitimate is asking you to go and buy a voucher and use it to pay for something. Except maybe your kids.
yes, that's true. Like, you would see some amazing and diverse crimes, I would imagine. When you think about those, is there anything that's still surprises you? Or have you just witnessed and been across so many different things that you go, well, you know, nothing surprises me these days?
No, I'm still surprised by things that people do. And, you know, my early days at Crime Stoppers, I think I had a what the moment about every 2 minutes of my day. I have less of those now, but I'm still surprised by what people do. And I'm surprised by how awful some people are prepared to be. And I'm also surprised by how brave some people are in coming forward to share what they know. That takes a lot of guts. It really takes courage. And I think that's why I love Crime Stoppers. I think we really bridge that gap for people who are afraid. We take away that fear. We give people confidence to come and just say, even if they're not 100% sure, they can come and say, there's no judgment here. There's no policeman standing there wanting to come and, you know, take a statement from you this very minute. But you can share it and you can feel confident that you've done your bit to make a difference.
Yeah, nice. Does everyone get a reward?
No, it depends really on the information and it does vary a bit across the country, but in Victoria it needs to lead to an arrest. And it also depends, there's a scale of rewards that are paid, but most people are not interested in rewards. And that was the other thing I found fascinating. I thought people were doing it for money when I first started. I thought this will be there will be lots of requests for cash, but that's actually not what motivates people. I think it might motivate some people, but the majority really just want whatever it is that's going on, they want it to stop.
To stop, yeah.
Okay,
you know, we could talk about this for years, but we won't. Let's go back to where it all began. So you're the youngest of six children.
I am.
To Irish Catholic parents.
True.
Grew up in Richmond. How was it being the youngest? Did you get away with a lot, or was it challenging?
I think it depends who you ask. If you asked my siblings, they would tell you I got away with blue murder. Yep. Well, I probably shouldn't, you know, use that analogy today or terminology today, but I didn't do anything that bad. But I got away with a lot. And I think there's probably something in that. By the time my parents had got down to me, I mean, there were five more before me. I think they're probably pretty exhausted by the time they'd dealt with the first five.
Yeah, you were just cutting loose and...
Well, it wasn't that bad, but...
So when we spoke prior, you said you were a pretty determined kid and somewhat rebellious.
I was.
What do you think fueled the rebellion?
I think I didn't particularly like being in a structured set environment. And I also didn't like being the kid that my brothers and sisters would spell over my head. You know, they were my nearest, closest sibling is 5 years older than me. So they spent a lot of time trying to get away from me, and I spent a lot of time trying to hang around. You know. I was that pesky sibling. So it used to really irritate me because they would spell the words about where they were going so that I couldn't go.
Yeah. You weren't...
One of those is a lawyer now, by the way.
Yeah, there you go. You weren't overly fond of school, were you?
No, not from the day I started to the day I left.
Yeah. And in fact, one day in year 10, you just decided, I'm not going anymore?
That's true, I did.
And your old man found out. What happened?
He did. It took a while, actually, because my parents were separating at the time, and it was probably a challenging time for everyone. And I have to say, I look back now and I think, what a horrible thing to do to your parents, add all of that stress on top of it. But yeah. But they survived. They were okay. So I didn't go to school for quite a while. I went to a Catholic school. There was concrete walls, barbed wire, nuns. Oh, wow. I know it sounds like a prison, and probably wasn't far from that, but that being stifled into this system just didn't work for me at all,
right.
And I didn't like it, so I didn't go. Yeah. And when my father found out, oh man, I was in trouble, and he was very strict. My father was a very strict man. He kept order with six kids. It was, and I'm sure that wasn't easy. But he said to me, "You've got two choices. You either go back to school and do commercial studies, as they had in those days, and for year 11, or you leave and you're likely to end up in a factory canning jam." Doesn't sound too flash. So back to school I went.
Right.
Quite humbly my first day, I have to say, head down, and knew I was in a fair bit of trouble, but I didn't care. I made it through year 11 and made it back into school. And, you know, I still have friends from school, and that's a long time ago. In fact, we caught up for dinner not so long ago. But, you know, I kept the friends, loved the friends part, just did not like school.
Mm. At school, did you... Was it clear to you what you wanted to do with your life?
No. I have to say in a word, no. I had never given it any thought. And I think, you know, my parents in those days, they would have been happy with me taking a job in the tax office or the bank. It would have been the perfect job, because it was a job for life in those days. That's what people valued. Went to work. People were given gold watches and, you know, for longevity of service. I'm not sure what they contributed during the time, but it was about how long you stayed and how loyal you were to your employer.
Yeah.
And I think for me that was a sense of drudgery. But I in year 11, towards the end of year 11 in commercial studies, one of the things that they did, and I still wish they did this for kids in a way, I don't quite know what they do now, but I wish they did something similar, was they took us to what was known as the CES then, the Commonwealth Employment Service, and in there they had all these jobs that were just on cards on the board, and you had to go, each of us had to pick a job off that board and apply for it. We had to write a letter, send a resume, and they helped us actually structure that up and say, all right, well, you know, these are the things you need to put in your resume, this is how you write the letter. And lo and behold, I got an interview. And before I knew it, I had the job. And I was like, oh, do I stay? You know, I've got a bit of time left at school. Don't want to can jam. I'm thinking this might be the place for me. So yeah. I took the job.
And what was that job?
I was working for a hairdressing and pharmaceutical wholesaling company. And it wasn't the greatest job in the world. It was an office job.
Yeah.
And because I then had very good, well, I thought I had pretty good secretarial skills. I could type, and I wasn't too bad on a phone. So I did that for, it must have been nearly 18 months. And then one of the guys in the warehouse there said to me, my mate's at Life Bien, and he's the head of PR there, and there's a job at Life Bien, and I think you'd be great. And I thought, well, I don't actually know how you know, because I don't know you that well, but fantastic, I'll give this a crack. And I thought, Life Bien, what a strange thing to be doing. And I remember going for my interview, and the lady who interviewed me said, so you'd be familiar with our programs Huff and Puff and Munch and Crunch? And I thought, no, but sure. And I spent 12 years at Life Bien.
Tell us about Life Bien, because, you know, it was such a amazing organisation full of a whole bunch of really, really talented and creative people. And you started as a
receptionist.
And you went on a journey. So tell us a bit. Tell us about that time, because was that the beginning of, you know, from your perspective, life, and you were, you know, right in it and finding something that you were passionate about.
And it was, but I don't think I actually knew it at the time. It was, I think, for me, I've come to realise over the years that one of the greatest mistakes people make is they think, I've got to get out of this job that I'm in. They're not so focused on where they want to be, what it is they really want to do. I took that job because I didn't like the job that I had. I didn't really understand what it was going to do for me. So I had some amazing opportunities at Life Beyond, and I did some strange things, you know, things that... people, and I say that, I mean, at one point I actually got to run up and down the Bourke Street Mall for a photo for a fun run wearing a Musketeers outfit. I mean, good God. I mean, who does those things?
Sounds like a great job.
So it's just some phenomenal things, and worked with all the sports. So I started as a receptionist. I moved into media.
Yeah,
working in the PR area, which was massive for us. We had community service announcements on TV. So I've done a lot of that work over the years, and it started at Life Beyond. And then I worked in the marketing area, so I was doing media, then marketing, and I got to work with all of our affiliates. So I learned about insurance and sporting organisations and all of the challenges that sporting organisations face, and encouraging people just to live a better life, to be happier, to be healthier. It was great. Fantastic.
Yeah. My generation, like Norm, I remember Norm on TV, and you know, the brains, the people that, you know, created that were there. What did you learn from those people?
Oh, so much from those people. And I think and different things to do and things not to do. So much for it. The creativity in Life Beyond was phenomenal. So Alex Stitt created Norm. And didn't have a lot of time to do that. It was a very quick turnaround. Philip Adams was in the agency. He'd given the brief to Alex. Yeah. And I think the first ad that Alex made, he created the Life Beyond family, and they all walked down to the pond for the day, and, you know, they did lots of stuff. And then they got in the car, and he was made the ad so quickly that he forgot to put the dog back in the car. And that became one of the things that stayed with Life Beyond for all of those years. You left the dog at the pond. You know? But his genius, he was just the most remarkable man. And you could stand with him and say, look, I'm thinking about, you know, designing. I want to do something on a swimming program, aquatics program. You know, what do you think? And he would just draw. He was just the most remarkable man. And he created the Sid the Seagull, the Slip Slop Slap campaign. Yeah, nice. Yeah. Ick Potter for The Age. I'm going back a bit now. I don't know if anyone remembers Care for Kids, but he did that as well. So his work is phenomenal.
That's amazing. We were talking earlier, one of the ironic things is, you know, Life Beyond It, all about, you know, health, etc. What did you do at your desk?
You remembered. I can't believe you remembered this. So back in the day when smoking was considered more acceptable, I used to smoke at my desk. And then so I used to say the policy of the office was very different to the philosophy, but it wasn't an anti-smoking campaign at that time. It evolved and changed as we came to understand more. But I do remember Alex Stitt telling me he would sit in advertising meetings where there'd be this big plume of smoke as everybody smoked their Camel cigarettes. And I don't know if you've ever been anywhere near a Camel cigarette, but they're disgusting.
Yeah.
So I think it was a different time. Yeah. It really was. And then they banned smoking in the corridors. and then they banned smoking altogether. And then I gave up smoking. That's a very long time ago now. But it seems a very odd thing to be doing, smoking at your desk when you're promoting health and fitness.
Oh, yeah. It's like, you know, I was a smoker for a long time. And the fact that I remember smoking in the car with the kids in the car, like, you know, just the most ridiculous things that now you think back and think, how do we do that? But I think it was just information.
It was. And I think Life Beyond It, you know, it evolved too. Yeah. So it was, it picked up that anti-smoking piece then as we came to understand more about the impact that it was having on people's health.
Yeah.
But you know, what a phenomenal campaign. I don't think there's been anything quite like it since, and I think people really bought into it at that time. There hadn't been anything like it, and they just engaged with it so much. People still remember Norm, as you say. You remember?
Oh, yeah. Sid, I still remember Slip, Slop, Slaps, Sid the Seagull, The Care for Kids. Like, they're imprinted in my, I don't know what age I was, let's go with 10, you know, in my brain.
Yeah. Amazing campaigns.
Yeah. So after Life Be In It, where did you meander off to there?
So then I formed an agency with Alex Stitt and his partner, and we worked on the Reading Writing Hotline, which the 20-somethings, a lot of them can sing the phone number. They don't know why they know it. They just know they know it. They don't know why they need to know it, but they know it all the same. So campaigns like that. I worked on projects for Emergency Management Australia, dealing with natural disasters. And I also spent several years working in a mortgage broking firm managing their business. So I had my daughter at that stage and I was looking for that sort of work-life balance. I think it's a bit – I don't want to say it's easier now, but it's there are possibly more options now than there were then. There'd probably be a whole lot of people who disagree with me. And I can say that from the comfort of having two older kids now, the options feel a whole lot easier. But managing, you know, the two kids were the absolute priority for me. They were then, they still are. You know, making them good people in their own right is what really mattered to me, and giving them opportunities.
Yeah, nice.
But for me it was then, you know, doing this mortgage broking piece. Well, I wasn't the broker, I was managing the business, and it was growing. It was, you know, interest rates were high. There was a lot of competition in the market and the business was really growing and, you know, doing some great work. So, and the campaigns, we kept the campaigns going as well. So I had great opportunities to do different things, and that to me is really important. You know, have a crack at something. I don't know where it's going to take you, but have a crack at it.
Yeah.
And I also volunteered in community sporting organisations. Yep. So again, that... not really understanding how that was going to help me, but in netball, so out at the Nunawading Netball Club, I was their president and I was the treasurer of the Baldwin Football Club for 3 years as well. When we transitioned across from the Southern Football League to the Eastern Football League, that was a whole lot of fun, but anyway. I think just learning from those organisations, you know, the connection in sport is it, what it does for people is phenomenal.
Yeah.
It gives people a connection in a way that they can't get anywhere else. It's, you know, you put players in jerseys and put them out on a field or a pitch and now they're a team.
Yeah.
And I've had the luxury of seeing that a number of times, and I see what volunteers give to a club, I see what they get out of a club. And I learnt so much along the way that I actually took that with me into my next role.
Is it that... you know, volunteering into something like that, was it the sense of community that was the attraction for you? Why did you do it?
Because I think we can all make a contribution, and I think, and that's not some sort of martyred, I want to be a saint here. Yeah. It's about how do I do something that will make things a bit better for people. And it was the same in the netball club, you know, doing things for the kids, seeing those kids happy, seeing the families happy and making it better for people. Why wouldn't you do it if you could?
Yeah, yeah, that's true. We were talking earlier about, you know, I don't know whether the word's dread, but you didn't love the structure and the system of the education system, nor the nuns, the concrete walls and the barbed wire fence.
Would you?
No. No, I would not. And I was fortunate that I didn't go to a school like that. But you was it always lingering in your head about education? And I guess from a corporate job or a career path, did you think you needed to do something about that?
Yeah, I did, but it wasn't so much about the job, it was about me. I wanted to do it, and I enrolled to do an accounting degree when I left school, and I thought, oh, this is so boring. I don't like boring things. That's something I learned about myself. I do not like to be bored.
Yeah.
And, you know, my mother would say, idle hands do the devil's work, you know, that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
So I don't be boring is really, you can be anything you want, but just not boring.
Yeah.
And I thought, I can't do this. I started it and I thought, I'd just, again, I would die if I had to stay with just boring accounting stuff. So I let it go. And I think I probably should have picked something else up then. But going into uni at the age that I was, you know, coming out of school then, uni wasn't as important as it is to people today.
Yeah.
I think, you know, my women back then, they became nurses or they became teachers. It wasn't, you know, that was your uni aspiration. It wasn't, can I please be the rocket scientist?
Yeah.
you know, those options weren't really there as much. And I don't think we were as aware of what the options were. So I think for me, when I left, when I was still at Life Unit actually, when I then decided I'd go to Swinburne and do the grad dip, and then I found out I was pregnant with my daughter. So I thought, no, now is not the time. I'm, you know, either I wasn't that committed, I think was probably my problem. So when the kids were older, I decided then that I would start a grad dip, and I started pretty much one subject at a time. I thought I'll do the grad cert and see how I go. Don't know if this is for me. Don't know if I can really write for uni. I'm not. That's not the way my brain works. I'm a fairly practical person. I'm not sure about this whole referencing and citations and stuff. But I started, and I actually thought, oh, it's probably not as hard as I thought it was going to be. My first subject, I finished with a mark of 92, and I thought, okay, maybe I can actually do this. And then I just kept going until I'd finished my master's. But even doing that, I took the opportunity to do different things. So I went to Prato with Monash to Italy to do a couple of subjects in Italy.
Nice.
And got to look at the fashion industry. So there are opportunities there. You've just got to look for them and find them.
Seek them out.
Yeah, so I went to Brussels with them. I've been to NATO, the European Union. And then I took the time when I was at Melbourne Victory to go to Arsenal and to the English Premier League to see how they worked. So there's some great opportunities I've had along the way, and
you've actually got to
put your hand up and say, I want to have a crack at that.
So you just mentioned Melbourne Victory. So how did you find your way to Melbourne Victory?
I was actually offered the job. I went in to do a handover for somebody, just a temporary role, and I was then offered the job. They were setting up the community department, and the club had been through a massive restructure. And community was managed by their marketing area, but they had, you know, one person in marketing and one person doing schools programs. It wasn't big. And they wanted to set up a community area. So knowing my background in community sport and Life Be In It, of course, and my interest in really engaging the community, I was offered that role. So, and then never looked back from there. I think I left three CEOs later, 6.5 years later. We'd built a phenomenal program. I mean, the team at Melbourne Victory in the community area, I had 5 full-time staff, 30 casuals, 25 community ambassadors, Archie Thompson, I'm not sure
not
phenomenal
personally.
Ambassador for, you know, when he was, both when he was playing and when he stopped playing. Phenomenal ambassador. You know, Archie and I get along really well. And I think his ability to engage people was something that the club was actually able to tap into.
So when you think about the success measures of creating a community for Melbourne Victory, what is that? Like, I listen to you say that, I go, okay, so what does that actually mean? What are you trying to do?
Well, we're doing a couple of things here, and that, I was back then, and that was engaging people with the club and also using sport to make a difference for people in the community.
Yeah,
and that was the part for me that I really loved. And the two worked hand in hand. Yeah. You know, we had programs, we delivered a program in youth justice, but it wasn't about just saying, look, here's a program. It was about working with the teachers at Parkville College and saying, how do we get something better for the kids, you know, how do we get them more engaged with their studies? And it might not be that they're kicking a soccer ball around every day or in this program. It might just be that there are players coming in to talk to them, or somebody's playing basketball with them or having a conversation with them that's different to what they're doing the rest of the time.
Yeah.
And then reaching into communities and to clubs and saying, you know, here are things we can offer you. And would you like to work with us? And had enormous success. And again, got to do some of the most amazing things. You know, I've been into youth justice a couple of times now myself. I'm so impressed by the work that Parkville College does. And they're really trying to make a difference for these kids. Now, the community, not as they're a bit, you know, oh, these are kids that have done a lot wrong. And there has to be a system that deals with people who do things wrong. But if we don't make any change for these kids and we don't give them any opportunities, then when they come back out, you've got exactly the same problem you had before they went in. So we have to find a different way to present them with new opportunities.
Yeah. There was I'd suggest a significant amount of your role at Victory was about, you know, championing diversity. You're an ambassador for Change Our Game. What does that mean to you?
It means a lot to me, actually. Yeah. And I think when I went into the club, they'd been through some struggles of their own. They'd had massive change, as I said before. There'd been a significant loss and they were rebuilding. But they all had a women's team that was sitting there. They'd been there for some years and nobody was really noticing. They were part of football, managed by Football Victoria at that time. So getting them some profiles and not having the girls actually have to sign a poster that's got only the boys on it, like how ridiculous is that?
Yeah.
You know, but that's what we had because the resources were limited and the focus wasn't on women's sport. So for me, it was about saying, how do we make this better for people? And whether it's the team or whether it's the staff that work there, what can we do that's actually better and fairer for people? So when I think about women's sport, you know, I've used the analogy before. I've got two kids, one boy, one girl. The girls would have to, in sport, would often have to get changed in the car or in the car park. I've got two kids. I wouldn't do that to them. I wouldn't say, look, you go out the back and you can get changed in the backyard, but you, son, you can have the special room up the front, you know. The room we only save for special people. Well, don't have one of those, but back in the day they would have. But that's the sort of thing, you know, it shouldn't be different, and you shouldn't have girls having to go into boys' change rooms and deal with urinals and things. Like, why? So I think the government here has done a lot to change that in Victoria. I think they've worked really hard with the clubs to make a difference here. But the boys were the special ones, and it's not their fault in the sense that they've just come into a system that has said you're special. So somebody's got to change that. There has to be some leadership in there that says, "Now, hang on a minute, we're equals here. We've got equal opportunity." And one of the things for me that seems probably quite small, but was actually for me a massive thing to achieve, was to get a poster created that had male player, female player, female. You know, there's side by side. It's not an issue for either one of them. They're very happy to be in those photos together. It's just that nobody's thought about it. Nobody's thinking about the impact that has on our kids when a poster goes out that's only got the boys on it. The difference between that and you can see males and females standing side by side, it says we're equal.
Yeah.
And that matters.
Yeah, that sure does. It feels like just in the last couple of years we've made some really big steps in the right direction with things like the women's AFL and, like, you know, in our local club that Nick's the president at the junior level, there's how many women's teams and girls teams now?
We have six female teams.
Yeah. And it's,
you know, and now seniors. So we have a development all the way through from juniors now leading to seniors. Seniors started with 13 women.
Yeah.
Now there's 40 plus.
Yeah. It's fantastic, isn't it?
It's incredible.
Isn't that brilliant?
It is. And just the atmosphere is, I was saying to someone the other day that I love going down and watching the girls and the women play. The atmosphere is,
it's very different.
So
it's
different.
Amazing.
It is so positive and inclusive, and it's not full of testosterone and anger and angst and that sort of shit. It is just, it's such a great place to be and experience sport.
It is. It's fantastic. And I think even in clubs, so if you think about the club that you're in, Nick, you know, opportunities for women to feel confident to come forward and volunteer. You know, often you would see the women in the canteen rather than taking on roles that might actually help them develop some skills and give them more confidence in jobs and, you know, and in their own lives to be part of committees where decisions are made.
Yep.
I think that to me is actually really, really important. I think, you know, I've dealt with the blokes in the footy club. I've been the only woman in the room of 100 men. And you all get to call each other mate, can I say. We don't have that luxury. You know, I can't walk into a room and say, hey, mate, how are you going? Because the 100 men in the room would be looking at me like I was crazy, for starters. And they don't want to spend their time hanging out with the one female in the room. So it's changed quite a lot. But I think clubs can do so much to empower women. And women are not as great at coming forward as they need to be. You know, we need to have more confidence. And we need men to say, hang on a minute, what about, you know, Julie or Sue, or, you know, she might be able to make a contribution here. So that encouragement from men to feel comfortable in that space, I think, is so, so important. for everything that we do. And women bring a, you know, they bring a different perspective, and it's not one you should be scared of. It's just different.
So on that point, the one woman in the 100 man and dealing with bias and unconscious bias, and how have you cut through? How have you got outcomes? What's your secret?
I'm not sure that there's any secret to it, but I think I've also been lucky. I'm not an anti-men person either, so I just want you to, you know, I want to be clear about that. I'm not a man hater. But I think that I've worked with some great men and I've worked with some great women, but I'm fairly determined. I don't, you know, I'm not taking anybody's crap anytime soon. So if you want to get in my way, then it's going to have to be something better than I'm a man and I know what you should be doing, because that's just not going to cut it.
That doesn't wash.
No.
Mansplaining doesn't work for you.
Not at all. So I think, you know, we've got a right to be, to make a contribution. We've got a right to be heard. And, you know, I've had men say things to me that, you know, I had one, I won't go near who that is, but I had one who held a senior leadership position, who stuck his hand on my arm one day and told me to shush in the middle of a meeting. Now, he would never have done that to my male colleagues, not in a month of Sundays.
Yeah, when he picked himself up off the floor, how did you respond?
Well, I was in shock at the time, but it wasn't so much a response then, because and I think this is the problem. It's the same problem that women have all the time, is they think it's just them. Yeah. They think it's an isolated incident, and you don't expect it to happen. It is wrong. It's just wrong to do it. And it means he's not showing me any respect, and he's telling everybody in that room that what I have to say doesn't matter.
Yeah.
And they don't have to listen.
Yeah.
So he should have known better. But what I did was I never sat close enough to him again that he was ever able to touch me. That was the first thing. So there was no, you have to reach a hell of a long way to get that arm across the room. And I used to direct my questions to other people. So I would never, if we were in that room, I would just, instead of having the conversation with him, I would say, if it was Nick, for example, I'd say, "So, Nick, what do you think about whatever it was?" Because I don't need to deal with that, but I also don't need to be unemployed. So, I think you've got to find your balance.
Yeah.
And there wasn't, I was the only female senior manager at Melbourne Victory. And I have to say, I had some fantastic opportunities. You know, I had a lot of support to do things, but I wanted other people to have support too. And I think, you know, it's getting better as time goes on, but we've just got to find a better way.
Yeah. How did you find, like, and I think I know the answer, but you were at Victory for a number of years. How did you find your way to become the CEO of Crime Stoppers from the Melbourne Victory Football Club? And had you coveted a CEO role? Is that something that was in your to-do list?
I don't think I had a to-do list, and I don't think covet's the right word, but I wanted different experiences. I like to challenge myself. As I've told you, I don't like to be bored. One of the first things I did was I wanted a board position. I thought I really want to understand how this works. So I joined I applied for a position in a not-for-profit board, and I did that for a few years. That was at Women's Health East. And I learned so much from those people. They are really incredible in what they're trying to do to make a difference for people, to make it fairer for women, just to create opportunities, again, organisations where there are opportunities for people.
Yeah.
But I think then I looked for different opportunities. What did I want to do from here? And, you know, there are going to be things where people say no to you. There'll be things that you think you might like to do that you actually realise later you probably wouldn't want to do, even if they'd come your way. But this particular job, I saw this come up. I'd been working, as I said, on Melbourne Victory's community programs and government relations as well. I had finished my work on the Melbourne Victory Academy bid. So we had a bid up to state government for $10 million in funding, and that would mean that there'd also be a home for our women's football team. So it was a youth development academy and a home for women to play football, and that had been missing over the years, you know. Mm. So the work on that had come to an end, and I thought it's time for me to do something different. It's been 6.5 years. I've had amazing opportunities here, but I want to do something else. And I'd been on the Blue Light Victoria board, I think for about 12 months, maybe more. And I saw this come. So Blue Light Victoria, I should explain to you, sorry, is a not-for-profit organisation that involves a number of police members and volunteers giving up their time to work with kids.
I thought they just ran discos.
Oh, lots of people do. Yeah. It's the fond memory thing. That's what I say. There are lots of fond memories attached to Blue Light, but they do some incredible work. And, you know, they're delivering programs in schools now through what's known as the Blue Edge program. Going out to kids and building that better relationship between police and kids and the community, and just presenting new opportunities for kids, you know, to try different things, to be part of, you know, they've got sports programs running. They're doing a whole lot of stuff just to make kids see that there are different things that they can do. So I'd been involved on that board, and then this opportunity came up. I'd also been involved in developing football programs in areas of disadvantage.
Right.
So when we think about, you know, we had places out in here, football programs in Hume, in Dandenong, or a number of different places. And these were programs that were taking football to the kids to say, look, you can come and play. You don't have to pay to do it, but you're doing something really positive, healthy, active, and not as structured. Some kids don't like structure. They can't commit to that level of structure to join a club. So we have to find other ways to take the sport to people. So from there, I'd had that engagement with Blue Light. This opportunity came up. I thought, oh, I've dealt with police a little bit. I can do this job. And that I applied, and it was quite a rigorous process, actually. And I'm pleased to say that that's, you know, I made it through that process.
Yeah. They went back over your rap list and saw that you'd you'd wag school for 6 months, and that never came up through the interview process.
No, they never went back to the nuns, thank goodness, because I don't think that would have ended well. But, it was my background as well in marketing.
Yeah.
So, you know, how can we take Crime Stoppers out to the people?
Yeah.
What can we do that's different, that engages people, that gets people involved in community safety, helps them learn to prevent crime themselves, and makes people feel safe? It's got to be a good thing.
It is. It's an amazing thing. Culturally.
Yes.
What was it like when you walked in that door, and was it, how different was it?
It was very different. So we were in a different location at the time, so we were sort of kind of isolated. We're still isolated in a sense. So Crime Stoppers is very much about, it's a not-for-profit organisation. It's a bit like me. It likes to be independent. I do say that, you know, when dealing with the police and some of our other stakeholders, my main task is to know when to hold them and know when to fold them. I've got the Kenny Rogers approach to life, you know. Stand up and be counted when you have to be, and just say, look, some of these other things probably really don't matter so much, so we're okay, we're good. But I think it is a different world, and I didn't really understand anything about policing. The only thing I knew was I didn't like to see them in my rearview mirror. You know, that's the only engagement, really. But they do the most remarkable job, and I think I've learned. It's the respect I have for them.
Mm.
So they go into situations where they have to be in control. They don't know what's coming. They don't know whether the person is violent, mentally ill, whether there's a gun in a house. They often don't know what they're dealing with, but we expect them to be calm and in control and have it all together when they come in. So, you know, they can't walk into a scene where somebody's screaming and start screaming themselves.
Yeah.
So we expect them to have it together. We rely on them to get it right for us and to keep us safe, but we don't want them on every corner unless we need one. Then we want one. So, you know, it's that sort of balance with them. And this is where Crime Stoppers fits in. We're bridging a gap here where people don't want to run up to the nearest policeman sometimes. They don't want to go into a police station. They don't want to call the police. It scares them. But Crime Stoppers can actually help there. You can come to us. There's no fear. You know, there's no judgment here.
Yeah. Tell us, what does being a leader mean to you, and what do the people around you get?
I think it's about being fair. For me, it's always fairness. Fair, not afraid to have a crack at something, and always, to me, my staff have to know that I've got their backs. Whatever, we're going to make mistakes along the way. Everybody's human. But it's not going to be the end of the world. We can fix it. So having that, really building that relationship with people where they feel confident to come to you and say, look, I think I've made a mistake here, or something's wrong, or I'm not coping, or whatever it happens to be, you know, that they feel confident to come in, that to me is leadership. And it gets the best out of people, you know. Yeah. Helping them develop is really important. You know, nobody now wants to do that 25-year job and get the gold watch and, you know, be recognised at their retirement for their longevity. They actually want to do something that makes them feel better about themselves and makes them, you know, they're contributing something. And I'd like to think that all of my staff know that they make a massive contribution to community safety as much as the work that, you know, the organisation, it's bigger than that.
Yeah.
They're doing something that makes a difference to other people.
Mm. You say you've got a commercial head and a community heart. I really like that. Using both your head and your heart, if you could instill, educate, change or transform something in our community today, it's a big question. What would that be?
I think for me, it would be about fairness for people. It's always that sense of giving an opportunity to people, making it fair, making it reasonable, making people be nice to each other and stop. You know, you don't need to do nasty stuff. You don't need to steal from somebody else to make you feel better. You don't need to feel that someone else's success is your failure. So if you're working with colleagues and someone gets a promotion, good for them. What can you do to make yourself better? Mm. Not bad them. Good me, you know, it's everything, encouraging people to give stuff a go and treat people fairly and equitably, I think would be the thing that I would do. It's probably a long-winded explanation, but fairness is really what I'm about.
it's a great thing to do, or great thing to aspire to do. So last question from me, and it's always our final question. What's on your to-do list? What's next?
I'm really wanting to take Crime Stoppers to new people, to young people, using it to really engage young people. For me personally, it's always going to be about learning and development. I don't have a plan for where I'm going, what job I'll take. If I had, I wouldn't be doing any things I'm doing now. I mean, if I'd made a structured plan 20 years ago, I probably would have been the accountant, you know.
So yeah, yeah.
Not that I have anything against accountants. They're very important people, especially at this time of year.
Yep.
I don't know what's next for me personally, but I know that I'm hoping it will always be something that gets better outcomes for other people.
Well, I've got no doubt that that will come true. Thank you so much for your time, Stella. You've made such a, I think, an amazing impact on the community. You're clearly, over many, many years, have been a community creator and a community shaper. So thank you so much for spending some time with us today.
It's been an absolute pleasure, and I have no doubt the scams conversation will keep going once we finish.
Yes, it will. Thanks, Stella.
Thanks very much.
Thanks, Stella.
Thanks, Blake. Thanks, Nick.
So that was Stella. What an amazing woman.
Yep, she really is. And I just love that she has remained true to her cause and loves the community that surrounds her and wants to give back.
Yeah, amazing. Hey, haven't we had a swag of CEOs on the Dolanders? So if our listeners are interested in hearing from more CEOs of a variety of different organisations, Nick, what episodes should they listen to?
Check out Tim Reed. David Ritter, he's the CEO of Greenpeace. James Thornton, the CEO of Intrepid Travel. Marcus Godinho, Matt Nation, Charles Davidson, Amit Baines, who's the CEO of the Western Bulldogs, and they might pull off a premiership this year in the AFL competition. David Harris and Tim Washington, who has started a electric vehicle charging infrastructure company that's taking over the country. Amazing.
It is amazing. Hey, Matt, who have we got on next week?
It's the one and only Dean Karanassis.
Can't wait to run a few Ks with Dean.
Yeah, I don't think we'll be doing that. He is the marathon man, and he never stops. Catch you all in episode 50, Dolanders.
Ciao.